This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. So listener, May is Mental Health Awareness Month and a good chance to check in with yourself. Some days feel fine, and other days you are lying awake at 2 a.m. running through every decision you have ever made. Lately for me, that has been work-related stuff. Just feeling a little stuck and not sure who to talk to about it without getting biased advice. And the truth is, no one has all the answers alone. That is where therapy comes in. With BetterHelp, you fill out a short questionnaire and they match you with a fully licensed therapist. They have been doing this for over 12 years with more than 30,000 therapists on the platform and have served over 6 million people. And if your first match is not the right fit, you can switch anytime. You don't have to be on this journey alone. Find support and have someone with you in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. In the summer of 1976, the local society pages of a Florida newspaper ran a small wedding announcement. A 19-year-old bride, a 69-year-old groom. The groom was the president of a local yacht club. The bride was hitchhiking through the state, sleeping wherever she could, supporting herself with whatever cash she could pull together off the side of the road. The two of them had met by accident. The marriage had come together inside of a few weeks. There was a photograph in the paper. There was language about the happy couple. There was a tone of mild local human interest. The sort of small town item that runs in a coastal Florida paper between the church news and the Lions Club calendar. 9 weeks later, the marriage was annulled. The groom had filed a restraining order. The bride had hit him with his own cane. She had come at the bartender at Bernie's Club and thrown a cue ball at his head. She had been arrested for assault and disturbing the peace at her own husband's expense. 9 weeks, 45 business days, give or take. From the society pages to the courthouse to a newspaper wedding photo that nobody was going to want printed anywhere ever again. The bride was Eileen Carol Warnos. By 1976, she was 20 years old. She had been on the road alone since her grandfather had thrown her out of the house in Troy, Michigan, in 1971, at age 15. She had logged thousands of miles by the side of various highways. She had picked up an arrest record. She had used at least one alias. She had been arrested at 18 in Jefferson County, Colorado, for, of all things, driving drunk and firing a .22 caliber pistol out of the window of a moving car. This is part two of a four-part series. Last episode, we walked her childhood, the fire at age six, the grandfather in the belt, the kitten in the bucket, the cigarette pig nickname at age 11, the pregnancy at 14, the baby boy taken from her in March of 1971, her grandmother Britta dying that July, her grandfather throwing her out a few weeks later, the sleeping bag in the woods on the edge of Troy. That is where we left her. Tonight, we follow her from there. All right, let's get on with it.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Chapter 1, The Long Hitch. The years between 1971 and 1976 are the hardest years of her life to reconstruct in any detail, because the years between 1971 and 1976 are the years she spent functionally invisible to the institutions that record people's lives. She was a teenage runaway, then a teenage drifter, then a young adult drifter. She was hitchhiking, mostly. She was sleeping in the woods. She was sleeping in motels when somebody else paid for the motel. She was sleeping in cars. She was sleeping at the back ends of parking lots. She was eating when she could. She was working the only line of work she had ever been taught how to work. Truck stops, rest areas, roadside bars, the kind of geography you can move through without leaving a paper trail, especially if you do not have a driver's license. and you do not have an address, and you do not have anyone calling around looking for you, or even caring to do so. What she did have was a certain skill at survival that does not show up on any aptitude test. She could read men. She had been reading them since she was 11. She knew which ones were going to hand her a sandwich and which ones were going to hurt her. She had a working sense of which gas stations and which bars were, on any given night, on the safer end of the spectrum. She drank. She smoked. She lost weight. She gained it back. She moved. The first arrest of any consequence happened on May 27, 1974, in Jefferson County, Colorado. She was 18. The arresting officers had a long list of charges by the time they got her booked. Driving under the influence, disorderly conduct, firing a .22 caliber pistol from a moving vehicle. The word disorderly does not communicate in 1974 cop shorthand what was actually happening on a stretch of Colorado Road, but the rough picture is that of a young woman drunk behind the wheel of somebody else's car with a pistol in one hand, putting rounds out the window into whatever happened to be on that side of the highway. She was booked under the alias Sandra Kretsch. She did not show up for a court date. She called an additional charge for failure to appear. She was already gone. The Colorado arrest is small in the context of what was coming, but I think it is one of the most quietly important details in her entire pre-Florida life. 18 years old, a pistol, car she didn't own, alcohol, an alias, the ability and willingness to point a firearm at the world and pull the trigger, anger, boredom, the rush, the self-soothing. 17 years before she would shoot Richard Mallory dead in the woods of Central Florida, 18-year-old Eileen Warnos was already out there on a Colorado highway, drunken with a .22. After the Colorado arrest, the trail goes cold for a stretch. She kept moving. She drifted south. Florida was the destination eventually. Cheap, warm, lots of people who do not ask too many questions. A coastline. Jobs and food service if you want them. And the more transient end of the economy. An entire culture of bars and motels and beaches where a young woman with a thumb out on the side of the road could move through without being asked for ID more than once or twice a week. She got to Florida sometime in 1975 or maybe 1976. She was 19 years old. She had no money, no plan, no permanent address. She had been on the road, in one form or another, for about half a decade. Then she met a man at a bar. Chapter 2, Lewis Fell. His name was Lewis Gratz Fell. He was 69 years old. He had been born in Philadelphia in 1907. He was the president of a local yacht club. He was, by every definition that existed in the Florida of the mid-1970s, a person of social standing. He had money. He had a house. He had social connections. He had, at the time he met Eileen, exactly 50 years on her in age. The exact mechanics of how they met are not crisply documented, but the broad strokes are. He was at a bar. She was at a bar. They started talking. He was charmed. She was, depending on the account you read, either genuinely interested or in a transactional mode or some blurred mix of both. The age gap did not matter to her in a way that would matter to most people. They got married within weeks of meeting. The wedding announcement made it onto the local paper. There was a photograph. There was a write-up. I want to say something straightforward about Lewis Gratz Fell, because I have read a few different framings of him in different sources, and I think the truth is somewhere in the middle of all of them. He was not a villain. He was not a predator in the criminal sense. By anything that is on public record, he appears to have been a lonely older man with money who met a young woman who was willing to be his wife and who said yes when he proposed. He took her into his home. He paid for things. He gave her, briefly, the closest thing to a stable address she had since she was 11 years old. By the standards of the relationship at the time she was used to having with men, he was, on balance, one of the better ones, and that's saying something considering the very large age gap. He was also, in objective terms, 50 years older than she was, and the dynamic of a 69-year-old marrying a teenager who'd been sleeping in cars and trading her body for cash since the age of 11 is not a healthy one. No matter how the older party intended it, there was no scenario in which that marriage was going to function on an equal footing. It was a transaction with romance painted over it, and the romance was thin. That romance cracked fast. Eileen, by every account that survived from the marriage, was not built for the role of yacht club wife in 1976. The drinking did not stop when she got married. The bar fights did not stop. She kept showing up at local establishments in moods that did not fit the paint on the wall. She was loud. She was confrontational. She was, by some accounts, openly contemptuous of the social class her new husband belonged to, in a way that would have been read at the time as ungrateful, and that in retrospect reads more like the inability of a deeply traumatized young woman to perform a role that her childhood had given her no tools to perform. You cannot drop a girl who slept in the snow at 15 into a yacht club banquet at 20 and expect her to know which fork to pick up, listener. The Kane incident is the one that gets remembered. By every public account I have read, Lewis Fell, at some point during the marriage, walked with the assistance of a cane. Eileen, at some point during the marriage, hit him with it. The reporting on the moment is not detailed enough to give you the inciting argument or the precipitating event, but the broad outline is that Eileen, in the middle of some kind of confrontation, took her 69-year-old husband's mobility aid and used it as a weapon against him. He filed for a restraining order. The marriage was, for all practical purposes, over. She left Florida and went back to Michigan. On July 14, 1976, in a place called Bernie's Club, Eileen Warnos got into an argument with a bartender. The argument escalated. She picked up a pool ball off the pool table and threw it at his head. She was arrested for assault and disturbing the peace. 3 days later, on July 17, 1976, her brother Keith died. Esophageal cancer. 21 years old, the boy who had been her co-conspirator and her co-victim, and by some accounts, the source of some of the deepest and most complicated harm she carried out of childhood. He was 21 years old. He had cancer in the part of his body where, statistically, 21-year-olds almost never have cancer. He died in 1976, the same year Eileen got married for 9 weeks, and the same year she threw that billiard ball at a bartender. He left her $10,000 in life insurance money. On July 21st, 1976, the marriage to Lewis Fell was annulled. From wedding announcement to legal annulment, 63 days, less than the length of an average summer vacation. A few weeks later, Eileen got a $105 fine for drunk driving. She used part of her brother's life insurance money to pay the fine. She used the rest of it on luxuries, including a new car. She wrecked the car not long after she bought it. By the time the dust settled on summer of 1976, the $10,000 from Keith was gone, spent, smashed up on a road somewhere, burned through the hands of a young woman who had never been taught how to hold money in her life. She was 20 years old. Her brother was dead. Her marriage was annulled. Her grandfather, Lowry, in March of that same year, had committed suicide. He had hanged himself the same way her father had, by his own hand. In a quiet room, she did not attend the funeral, listener. Take inventory of the people who had been in her life as a child. Her mother gone, her father dead, her grandmother dead, her grandfather dead, her brother dead, her son, somewhere out there in the country, being raised by other people, her 9-week husband divorcing her with a restraining order in his hand. By the close of 1976, every single biological tie Eileen Warnos ever had to another human being on this planet was either deceased or estranged. She was 20. She was, in the most literal sense the word can carry, an orphan, and she was angry. Chapter 3, The Hole. There are a couple of years here that move fast and slow at the same time. She drifted back south. Florida pulled her back the way Florida pulls a lot of people back. She ended up in the Central Florida corridor, the strip of Daytona Beach down through Volusia County and over toward the Gulf, the flat scrubland of two-lane roads and gas stations and motels and bars that would eventually become the geographic theater of everything she would become known for. She did not have a plan. She had a thumb on the side of a road and a body that could be exchanged for cash and nothing else. In 1978, at age 22, she shot herself in the stomach. This was not the first suicide attempt. According to public record, between the ages of 14 and 22, she attempted suicide 6 times. Different methods, different settings, different levels of seriousness. The 1978 attempt is the one that left a recorded mark, because the round actually went into her body, and she lived to be hospitalized for the wound. a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the stomach at 22 years old by a young woman who had been trying to remove herself from this life on and off for the previous 8 years. I want you to think about for a second what it means to attempt suicide 6 times in 8 years and survive all 6 attempts when they were serious attempts. This was not a person performing. This was not seeking attention. This was not even a cry for help. There was no one to cry out to help for. That is a person whose life is, at the core engineering of it, unlivable, and who has been trying repeatedly to exit, and who has run into strange obstacles 6 times in a row, that her body refused to die. There is a kind of cruelty in surviving that many attempts. The brain does not get to start over. It just wakes up the next morning in the same body, in the same circumstances, with the additional layer of failure stacked on top of everything else. Eileen woke up in a Florida hospital with a bullet hole in her stomach in 1978. She walked out of that hospital eventually and went back to the same life. The same roadsides, the same bars, the same motel rooms, the same cars, the same men. The mind had decided it could not live with itself in 1978, had been ruled by the same body that refused to die in 1962 when her face caught fire. The body was going to keep her alive, whether she wanted it or not. And so, the arrests started piling up. May 20th, 1981, Edgewater, Florida. She was 25. She walked into a convenience store with a gun. She demanded the cash from the register. She walked out with $35 and 2 packs of cigarettes. That was the take. Whatever a convenience store was holding in the till, at whatever hour she walked in, that was what she took. It was, in any objective accounting, one of the smaller armed robberies on the book that year. $35 in 1981, adjusted for inflation, is about $120 today. 2 packs of cigarettes is, then and now, $9 or $10 worth of merchandise. She stuck a gun in the face of a working person to get a couple of meals worth of cash and smokes for the road. Whatever calculation she had made about risk versus reward in that moment, the math she was working with had nothing to do with the math the rest of the world does. She was arrested. She was charged. On May 4th, 1982, she was sentenced to prison. She served 13 months. She was released on June 30th, 1983. She walked out of the Florida correctional system at 27 years old with a felony conviction. No money, no driver's license under her real name, and the same skill set she had walked in with. She went back to the same road, the same bars, the same gas stations, the same motels, the same cars. On May 1st, 1984, she was arrested again, this time for attempting to pass forged checks at a bank in Key West. She had been writing checks she did not have the authority to cash. She had been doing this in a Florida bank, in person, in front of tellers, without any kind of disguise or cover story that even a moderately competent forger would have set up. The bank called her. The police called her. Another file on the stack. In November of 1985, she was named as a suspect in the theft of a revolver and ammunition in Pasco County, Florida. The revolver in question was a small caliber. She was using an alias by then. She had been using one for a while. This name she put on her ID was Lori Grody. Lori Grody was, in real life, the name of one of her aunts back in Michigan. She had picked the alias out of her own family tree, which, given how she felt about her family, is a detail with its own quiet weight. 11 days after the Pasco County gun theft suspicion, the police pulled over Lori Grody for driving without a license. On January 4th, 1986, in Miami, the police pulled over Lori Grody again, this time in a stolen car. She was charged with grand theft auto, resisting arrest, and obstruction of justice for using a false identity. The Miami officers searched the car. They found a .38 caliber revolver and a box of ammunition. A few months later, on June 2nd, 1986, in Volusia County, sheriff's deputies pulled over a vehicle and detained Eileen for questioning. The reason was that a male companion in the car was alleging that she had pulled a gun on him during the ride and demanded $200. She denied the claim. The deputies searched her. They searched the vehicle. Eileen was found to be carrying spare ammunition. Underneath the passenger seat where she had been sitting, the deputies recovered a .22 caliber pistol, the same caliber she had been firing out of a moving car in Colorado at age 18, the same caliber that, in the spring and summer of fall 1990, was going to put rounds into seven men along Florida highways. By the summer of 1986, more than 3 years before the first murder, Eileen Wuornos was already moving through the world with a .22 in arm's reach and spare ammunition in her pockets. That detail is going to matter so much in the eventual trial. She had been an armed and dangerous person, by any reasonable definition, for at least a decade before her trial. Chapter 4, A Bar Called Zodiac. I want to tell you about a place, listener. The Zodiac was a gay bar in Daytona Beach, Florida, in the 1980s. It served the lesbian community more than the gay male community. It was a working-class, blue-collar, no-frills sort of place. Pool tables, beer signs, a jukebox, cheap drinks, a particular kind of regular crowd. By the mid-1980s, it was one of the central social spaces for queer women in Central Florida who did not have a lot of other options for where to be on a Friday night. In 1986, Eileen Wuornos walked into the Zodiac and met Listener. After diving deep into another true crime story, I've been loving a little wind-down ritual at the end of the night. And that's exactly why I'm obsessed with Mood. Mood is the online spot for federally legal, hemp-derived cannabis grown on small, pesticide-free family farms right here in the U.S. They ship gummies, flower, edibles, pre-rolls, and more discreetly straight to your door. No lines, no hassle. They've got something for every vibe. Chill for sleep, focused for deep work, happy and euphoric when you just want to feel good, or even that extra spark for better sex. My go-to lately, their Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies. Super smooth, mind-soothing calm that kicks in fast and leaves me waking up clear. No grogginess. Perfect after a long day. And right now, first-time buyers get 20% off your entire order when you use my code Obscura at checkout. Head to mood.com, find the gummy, flower, or edible that matches your perfect mood, and save 20% off with code Obscura. Everything's backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. Go to mood.com/obscura and try it today. Listener, let me tell you about Chime, because my younger self would have benefited from this. You know how traditional banks love to nickel and dime you? Overdraft fees, monthly fees, paying to use an ATM just to get your own money. Chime isn't playing that game. No. It's fee-free banking that's built for you, not the 1%. Here's what you get. Up to $1,150 a year in rewards, 5% cash back on a category of your choice, like gas or groceries, savings that grow with a 3.75% APY, which is 9 times higher than the national average, premium travel perks like airport lounge access, and a 24/7 travel concierge. They even have SpotMe, so you can overdraft up to $200 fee-free. And if you need cash now, MyPay lets you grab up to $500 of your paycheck early. That's why Chime was named America's number one choice for banking. Head to chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. It only takes a few minutes to sign up.
Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services for MyPay and Chime card provided by Chime's bank partners. Optional products and services may have fees or charges. Stated annual percentage yield and cash back for Chime Prime only. No minimum balance required. Checking account ranking based on a J.D. Power survey published October 20, 2025. For more information on APY rates, MyPay, SpotMe, and travel perks, go to chime.com/disclosures.
A 24-year-old motel maid named Tyra Moore. Eileen was 30. She was 6 years older than Tyra. She had a felony record. She had a string of arrests. She had a stolen .38 in her recent past and a stolen .22 in her recent present. She was working the highways in Central Florida as a sex worker, which was almost the only employment she had ever held in her entire adult life. She was, by every available account, a hard person to be around. Loud, volatile, deeply suspicious of anyone who seemed to want to be close to her. Quick to anger, quick to leave the room. Tyra was younger, quieter by all accounts, a nicer person, in the conventional sense of that word. She worked at a motel cleaning rooms. She was not from Florida. She was from Pennsylvania originally. She was getting by. She was figuring out who she was. The Zodiac was the kind of place she could be herself in on a Saturday night, not have to fight for it. The two of them met. They started talking. Within a short period of time, they were in a relationship. Listener, I want to be careful here, because the Eileen and Tyra relationship is one of the most complicated parts of the story. and most public treatments of it have gotten it slightly wrong in one direction or the other. The shorthand version is, they were lovers and Tyra became Eileen's accomplice. The shorthand is wrong in important ways. The most honest version is that they were, for a period of about 4 years, the closest thing to a stable family unit either of them ever had. They moved in together. They lived together. They ate together. They slept together. Eileen supported them, materially, with the money she made off the highways. Tyra worked motel jobs intermittently. They had their fights, the way couples have fights, and they have their good periods, the way couples have their good periods. They moved around constantly, from rooms to trailers to friends' couches, the way two people without much money move when they cannot quite get a stable address to hold. The thing that made it different from a regular relationship was the underlying texture of who Eileen was, which is to say, an adult who had never been emotionally regulated, who had been told from the age of 2 onward that she did not deserve to be loved, who had no template for what a healthy bond looks like, and who was now experiencing, possibly for the first time in her life, what it felt to come home to somebody who actually cared whether she made it through the day. That was new for her. That was, in some ways, more destabilizing than the absence of love ever had been. People who have been starved for affection often do not know what to do with it when it shows up. They cling. They grip. They do not believe it. They sabotage it. They suffocate it. Eileen, by every account that survives from people who knew them, did all those things. She was also, throughout the relationship, doing the work that paid for it. The work that paid for it was the work of a sex worker, truck stops, rest stop areas, the shoulders of 2-lane roads, the same circuit she had been working since she was a teenager, only now in her 30s, with a partner at home she was trying to feed. She was getting in and out of cars with strange men, 20, 30 times a week. She was, by her own later testimony, raped on the job multiple times. She was beaten on the job multiple times. She was robbed on the job. She had guns pulled on her. She had knives pulled on her. She came home sometimes with bruises she could not explain to Tyra.
And I'm going to have them on judgment day in front of me, and they're going to pay for their wrongdoing. I was raped, tormented badly, because I really did take my past and just throw it in the river. I mean, I never thought on my, I never dwelt on my past. Every day was a new day for me. I said to myself, I said, if anybody ever comes up to me again and ever tries to rape me like that, he will definitely wish he had not met this prostitute. It wasn't every day. I was out prostituting, and I was dealing with hundreds and hundreds of guys. You got a jerk that's going to come along and try to rape me, I'm going to fight.
But most prostitutes encounter some kind of
violence.
Yeah,
what do? They get killed or something then?
Some
I don't believe in that.
In the fall of 1985, Eileen was named a suspect in stealing a gun. In January of 1986, she was caught driving a stolen car in Miami with a revolver in it. In June of 1986, she was caught with a .22 pistol underneath her seat. In July of 1987, she and Tyra were both detained in Daytona Beach in connection with a bar fight in which somebody had been hit with a beer bottle. In March of 1988, Eileen filed her own police complaint against a Daytona Beach bus driver, alleging that he had pushed her off the bus during the confrontation. Tyra was listed as witness to that incident. The last detail is, I think, one of the most underappreciated moments in the timeline. By 1988, Eileen Warnos had become a person who was confident enough in her own legal standing to file complaints with the police. She became a person who, in her own self-conception, was the wronged party in a confrontation with strangers. The bus driver had pushed her. The bus driver was at fault. She had a witness. The narrative of grievance was already structured. The pattern of the wrong party reaching for a weapon to right the wrong, which was going to come out in full force 2 years later on the side of the interstate. She had been wronged by everyone. In her own telling, she was always the wronged party. She was always the one in the right. That mental framework matters. It is going to be the one she carries into 1989. Chapter 5, The Long Tail. The 80s were not, on paper, a particularly violent period in Eileen's life. She had not killed anyone yet. She had robbed a convenience store. She had threatened a man with a gun in a car. She had thrown punches in bars and thrown things. She had hit her husband with a cane. She had been in custody for short stretches. She had been released from that custody onto the same street she had come from. The arrests piled up, but they piled up at the level of quality of life misdemeanors and small grade felonies, not at the level of homicide. But the road was going downhill. She was getting older. The body was getting older. The work she did to make the money was harder on a 30-year-old body than it had been on an 18-year-old body, and harder still on a 33-year-old body than it had been on the 30-year-old body. The men in the cars were not getting nicer. The cash was not getting easier to come by. The arrests were getting more frequent. The aliases were getting harder to keep track of. The drinking was steady, daily, structural. She was angry. She had always been angry. The anger had been hammered into her by the man she called Daddy, and it had lived in her body since she was a child, and it had been refined and confirmed by every interaction with a male customer who had handled her badly on the job, and it had become, by her late 20s and into her early 30s, the single most consistent emotional baseline she had. The men in the cars were not, in her view, simply individual transactions. They were, on some level, the same man as the grandfather, the same man as the friend of the grandfather, the same man as the bus driver, the same man as the bartender at Bernie's Club, the same man as Lewis Fell with his cane. The world was full of men who took something from her, and she had not been able to refuse any of them, ever, since she had been small. I want to flag something here, in fairness to the historical record and keeping things on balance, because the next thing I'm about to say is the thing that the legal system would later have to wrestle with. Eileen was, on the job, genuinely victimized by men. That is real. The work she did was dangerous. Sex workers in Central Florida in the late 1980s were statistically among the most assaulted populations in the entire state. That she was raped at gunpoint on the job, that she was beaten on the job, that she was robbed on the job, is consistent with the experience of an entire population of sex workers in the era and the geography. Her grievances were not invented. The men in some of those cars were indeed violent. I don't think there's any question about that, listener. I don't think it's to doubt. This is something people doubt a lot, and I get it. A lot of serial killers fabricate a lot of things. But this had been Eileen's job her entire life, and it's not surprising that more than a few of these guys took advantage of her and hurt her and left her feeling like that child she was in the woods all those many years ago. And there was something inside her that was building, and she was starting to look at every man the same. And when all men become rapists, they all become targets for revenge.
Anybody who rapes, to me, is a sick, deranged piece of puke that doesn't even deserve to live.
But what is also true is that being a victim of violence on the job does not, by any reasonable framework, give you a license to shoot the next several men who get in a car with you. The legal system would eventually agree with this statement, but the line between those two frames, the frame in which Eileen was a victim and the frame in which Eileen was a killer, is going to be blurred in the next stretch of her life in ways that the news media of the 1990s and the cottage industry of true crime that has grown up around her in the years since has had a very difficult time keeping straight. I'm going to keep them straight on this show. Both things are going to be true at the same time. She was being hurt. She was also planning to hurt back. The planning to hurt back is the part that is going to be hers to own, and we are going to make her own it. But we are not going to pretend that the hurting was not happening on the other side of the equation, because it was. And pretending otherwise is intellectually dishonest and empathetically as well. In November of 1989, all of that was going to come together. Eileen was 33 years old. She and Tyra had been together for 3 years. The relationship was strained, the money thin. The work was getting harder, the drinking was constant. The anger was at, by every measure that would later be examined in court, the highest level it had ever been in her life. A man named Richard Mallory was about to drive a 1977 Cadillac into a wooded area in Citrus County, Florida. But that, listener, is for the next episode. Chapter 6, Susan Blahovic and Other Names. I want to circle back to the aliases for a minute, because the aliases tell a quiet story underneath the obvious one. Eileen Wuornos, by the late 1980s, was operating under at least four or five different identities, depending on which encounter with which jurisdiction we're talking about. Lori Grody, Susan Blahovic, Sandra Kretsch, Tina Moore, Cammie Marsh Green. There were others. The names rotated. She used different ones in different counties for different reasons. Some of them she used to dodge specific outstanding charges. Some of them she used because her real name was, by then, on enough warrants and watch lists that operating as Eileen Warnos was harder than operating as anybody else. The Lori Grody alias is the one that catches me, because Lori Grody was a real person. Lori Grody was Eileen's biological aunt back in Michigan. By using that name, Eileen was, in a strange and probably unconscious way, doing two things at once. She was protecting herself from her own identity, and she was tying herself, in the only way she knew how, to a family she could not actually go home to. Lori Grody, the real one, was somewhere in Michigan, living her own life, presumably unaware that her name was being run on traffic citations in Central Florida by a niece she had not seen in years. The fact that Eileen reached for her aunt's name of all the names she could have made up out of thin air says something about her interior weather. She was, even when she was running, still trying on some level to belong to a family. The Susan Blahovic name was the one that ended up on the most paperwork. By 1987, Susan Blahovic had her own little file in the Daytona Beach Police Department's records. Susan Blahovic had been ticketed for walking on the highway. Susan had been ticketed for driving with a suspended license. Susan had been issued a citation that, in the language of the officer who wrote it, came with the editorial note that her attitude was, quote, poor. Susan had, by 1988, sent threatening letters to a court clerk about the suspended license citation. The Susan Blahovic file ran in parallel to the Eileen Warnos file, and the two files had no idea they were the same person. The reason the aliases matter is that they were making her, in a real and operational sense, ungovernable. The Florida criminal justice system in the 1980s did not have the kind of integrated database that would have connected Lori Grody to Susan Blahovic, to Sandra Kretsch, to Eileen Warnos. Each name was a different person to each county clerk. Each name had a different rap sheet. Each name had different open warrants. By moving among them, Eileen could keep the system from ever fully assembling the picture of who she was and what she was doing. That is the long, quiet ramp that leads into 1989. Not just a woman with a record and a temper, but a woman with five records and five tempers distributed across administrative landscapes that was not capable of seeing her as one person until something big enough happened to force that integration. The thing that was going to force the integration was a body in the woods. Chapter 7, The Lay of the Land in 1989. By the start of 1989, here's where Eileen Warnos stood. She was 32 years old, going on 33. She had been working the Florida highways as a sex worker for, on and off, more than a decade. She had a felony armed robbery conviction. She had a string of misdemeanor and small felony arrests under at least four aliases. She had been suspected of stealing at least two firearms. She had been caught with a .22 caliber pistol underneath her seat in a vehicle in Volusia County. She had been accused of pulling a gun on a man and demanding money. She had a long-term partner, Tyra Moore, in a relationship that was, by some accounts, deteriorating. By other counts, the only thing keeping her tethered, anything that looked like normal life. She had no permanent address. She and Tyra moved between trailers, motels, friends' couches, and short-term rentals. She had no credit. She had no checking account that was not under somebody else's name. She had no driver's license under her own name that was current. And she had a very, very short fuse. She had a working knowledge of the Central Florida road system. She knew which exits had which gas stations. She knew which truck stops had which kind of clientele. She knew which highways were patrolled at which hours and which were not. She knew the wooded areas off the main routes, the dirt roads that branched off the asphalt, the places where you could pull a car 100 yards into the trees and not be visible from the highway anymore. She had a body that had been violated since before she could remember, and a mind that had been cataloged every time it had been violated, and a register of grievance that had grown so large by 1989 that it had, in some cognitive sense, started to be the primary interpretive lens through which she understood every interaction with every man she ever encountered. And she had a .22 caliber pistol. The pieces were on the table, listener. The state of Florida did not yet know it. Tyra Moore did not yet know it. Eileen herself and the conscious daylight version of her own thinking may not have known it, but the pieces were on the table nonetheless, and the alignment was already happening at the edges of awareness. 18 years lie between the sleeping bag in the snow and the first body on the side of a Florida highway. Most of those 18 years are not on the surface dramatic. They are gas stations and motel rooms and rest stops and county jails. They are forged checks and traffic citations and bar fights and drunk driving fines. There are aliases that piled up in different file cabinets in different cities. They are the slow accumulation of a life lived almost entirely in transit by a person who never had the chance to build the boring scaffolding the rest of us take for granted. A driver's license, a bank account, a landlord, a doctor, an employer, a friend who's known you since childhood. Eileen had none of those things in any stable form. For any meaningful stretch of her adult life, she had Tyra eventually for 4 years. She had her brother Keith briefly until cancer took him. She had Lewis Fell for 9 weeks until the cane. She had a lot of strangers in cars and a lot of overnight motel clerks and a lot of bartenders and a lot of arresting officers. And that was, in the end, the bulk of who she encountered. The wedge between her and the rest of society was being driven a millimeter at a time. Every year, every arrest, every alias, every drunk driving fine, every man in every car. By 1989, the wedge was deep enough that she could not see the rest of society from the position she was operating in, and the rest of society was not really capable of seeing her either. She was the off-map of normal life. She had been off the map for so long that the map makers had stopped trying to put her there. Next episode, we are going to walk through the seven men: Richard Mallory, David Spears, Charles Karskadin, Peter Symes, Troy Burress, Charles Humphreys, Walter Antonio. 7 men, 12 months. We're going to walk that timeline. But that is later. Tonight, before I let you go, I want to do what I always try to do on this show, which is bring it back to the people on the edges of the story. Louis Gratz Fell, the yacht club president, the 69-year-old groom in the Society Pages photo, he went on with his life after the annulment. He died in January 2000, 24 years after the marriage that ended in 9 weeks in a restraining order. Whatever he made of those 9 weeks and the rest of his years on Earth is not a part of any record I have access to. But he was a real person, and he had a real life on either side of the brief crash named Eileen. And he counts as one of the many people her path crossed and damaged in ways that did not make a headline. I mention him here now because there'll be no reason to mention him in the future. And then back to Eileen, a mind that has stored every grievance for 33 years and has, by then, structured the entire male population of Central Florida into a single composite enemy. The first body on a Florida highway was 12 months away. Thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning.